Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.
Well, markets climbed a wall of worry this year, and some are cashing in at the top. The JSE's up almost 30%, closer to 50% in dollar terms. The rand's eyeing sub-17 to the dollar. We're running surpluses fiscally, and even S&P likes us again. But can the good times roll into 2026? Anchor's Peter Armitage is here to break it all down. Peter, great to chat to you, and what a year it's been. I think if you had told investors 12 months ago that with Trump 2.0 and tariff wars and all of this AI mania that we'd be looking at those kinds of returns, they would have snapped your arm off. How do you make sense of, firstly, the global backdrop where tariffs went up? We saw a lot of geopolitical tension flaring all over the place. There was this AI spend exploding, and yet markets, both locally and globally, climbed that wall of worry.
So, Michael, the big concern with tariffs was the impact through into inflation globally, and that just simply hasn't happened. He has been saved a little bit by shelter and service employment to being lower. And why this is relevant is it's meant because inflation has not kicked up in the US like people thought it would. So tariffs have not been as material as people expected. It's meant that the Federal Reserve can reduce interest rates. So they've done that a few times and expected to do that a few times more. So that's stimulatory to the US economy. You add to this, and it's very fortuitous for Trump, that this AI spend boom, which is the biggest CapEx spend boom in the history of mankind, has happened at the same time. So you've got a few factors conspiring together to create big US earnings growth. And the expectations for earnings in America for the next 2 years are well above average and very strong. And a lot of the stuff that Trump caused chaos with has in fact landed up being a positive. So for example, the weaker dollar. And the weaker dollar means that all of the investments that American companies have got offshore, when they bring that money back into South Africa, sorry, into America, it's worth more dollars.
Yeah.
So, you know, while there's been absolute chaos, the actual earnings outlook on the ground, which is a primary driver of markets, has been quite positive. So you're approaching a 20% year to date in the US markets.
Yeah. And I recall at the beginning of the year, at almost every investment conference I attended, everyone was just pointing to valuations and the fact that we've had this decade and a bit of US exceptionalism, and it's probably toppish. But look at what the US economy has done. And I think a lot of it, I mean, you mentioned that AI CapEx spend. Do you see this as the new fiscal stimulus? Because we're looking at, what, $300 to $400 billion US dollars in AI infrastructure CapEx this year alone. And I wonder how sustainable that is into 2026.
So you're certainly going through a phase where, and it's largely these big five or six tech companies in the world are each spending between $50 and $100 billion projected this year, next year, the following year. It's unprecedented spend. And you must remember that spend flows through into the general economy. A big CapEx spend in a data center needs logistics, it needs services, it needs cars, it needs roads, etc. So to put that in context, I mean, the size of the South African GDP is $400 billion. So they're spending all of South Africa's GDP in 1 year by five companies. So lots of question marks. And the favorite question on investment markets at the moment is whether this money is being well spent. You know, the added concern is they're spending money on technology, which will no doubt be out of date in 3 years' time as the chips get refreshed. So I think without a doubt, some of the spend won't get a fantastic return. But the companies are forced to spend. It's a bit like just opening a fire hose because they simply can't be left behind in the fast-changing technology world. So they're building capacity. The history of capacity is people tend to overbuild. You know, that's what's concerning people. The reality, though, is you'll only know in 3, 4, 5 years' time to what extent they've overbuilt. So the market's giving them the benefit of the doubt at the moment. But, you know, while all of that's happening, that spend is flowing through into the real economy, and GDP growth numbers for the US are getting pushed up. I mean, the other thing to remember, this is all going, I mean, bizarrely, to one company, NVIDIA. They make a 75% gross margin. They make a 65% operating margin. They're making wildly excessive profits out of this because of the scarcity of their product. Nobody else can produce. But there's a lot of people in the wings, you know, scaling up. The companies are looking to produce themselves. So, you know, you've got NVIDIA now at a $4.5 trillion company. It was the number 60 company in the world a few years ago, and it's quickly raced to number one by quite some margin.
Yeah, and with earnings out this Wednesday, it really will be the bellwether on how much longer this AI-fueled boom can continue. But they do say in a gold rush, you know, you buy the shovel manufacturer, and that's very much what NVIDIA's GPUs have become. You mentioned, though, the depreciating and accounting issues around this. I think Michael Burry raised it famously of Skion Asset Management, and as he's now closed the firm, but he was very famously of The Big Short, saying these tech firms, Meta and the rest of them, are not correctly accounting for the fast depreciation of these chips, which should be, what, 12 to 24 months, given how quickly the technology moves. And they're depreciating these assets over 4 to 6 years. Do you think there's a fair case to be made for that?
Yeah, I think he's probably correct. But where we might differ is in, you know, the impact on the markets. You know, the tech companies are being valued at 25, 30p multiples on massive cash flows. And that's the big difference. Is a company like Meta, which is Facebook and Instagram primarily, you know, they're making $100 billion and spending 70 of it on all of this new capacity. So it's not like, you know, the internet companies of 20 years ago where they bet their entire future and if they didn't get a good return, it would be a disaster. Meta might well, in 3 years' time, have spent $200 billion and have overspent and not depreciating it quickly enough. But it's, you know, it's not an all fall down scenario. They're making enormous amounts of cash and spending some of that cash. They probably should be depreciating a little faster. I think the way they're depreciating it would seem kind of logical. But, you know, on the other side of technology really is advancing so fast. They're going to be out there in the foreground. You know, they'll continue spending money. They'll take advantage of what's happening. I don't think whether they depreciate over 3 years or 6 years is something that's going to change the value of the company dramatically. So I don't think the impact of what he's talking about is as material as he's assuming in his giant shorts on these companies.
Yeah, very interesting. But it is one of those things, I'm sure, at your investment meetings that is debated wildly when it comes to...
It's probably the key topic, yeah.
Absolutely. And I mean, on the other side of it, you've got Sam Altman at OpenAI calling for a government backstop and then quickly rolling that back and saying, no, the market misinterpreted what he was saying. There is debt that's being, you know, raised in certain quarters. Not all of the companies are as cash generative as some of the more established firms, certainly in the AI trenches, you know, the ChatGPTs, the Claudes and the rest of them. If you were to be playing the AI theme into next year, where would you be accessing the AI theme? Would you be going directly into NVIDIA? Where do you see the value?
Yeah, so I think there's, you're quite correct. You're going to break it up into a few different parts. You've got the big companies that are spending current cash flows on AI. So, you know, they've got, even if it doesn't work out quite as expected, they've still got those existing cash flows and they're maintaining those and protecting those by their spend. And I think that's probably the safest place to take the exposure at the moment. So through the Metas, through the, you know, through the Alphabets, et cetera. NVIDIA sits quite uniquely in the middle of it as a service provider. It's being priced for quite strong, sustained increase in spend off record levels. So it's much riskier than the guys who are spending money who could simply just slow down their spend. You know, and NVIDIA is at a $4.5 trillion company. So you really have hit the law of diminishing returns. So if everything's phenomenal, you know, can it become a $5 trillion or six, you know, possibly, but it's your upside is I think a lot of it's happened already. Then you've got, you know, the other guys who are not in the category of the big cash flow generators and who are uniquely in the space, and it's the only space they're playing. So an OpenAI, that's dramatically more risky than the existing businesses that are spending cash flow, because they've got to go and raise capital, they've got to take on debt, and you're getting a number of newer players who are in that new company space. But, you know, quite oddly, you know, there isn't much of that that's actually listed. Those tend to be kind of startup type companies. You would expect OpenAI to list as soon as they've got a more certain handle and kind of trajectory. So the listed companies we think are by and large fine. There's obviously AI companies at the fringe that have caught the appeal of the market and are trading at crazy multiples. But it's OpenAI would, if it was listed, fit in the category of a... you know, that could fail if we've all got this kind of story wrong, whereas the other big tech companies are certainly not in that category.
Yeah, and that's sometimes where I look at SoftBank as the ultimate contraindicator, right? Recently selling all of its NVIDIA stake, I think, for $5.8 billion to go all in on OpenAI. This is the same company that punted WeWork, lest we forget. And it just seems to be one of the more curious investment decisions that I've seen of this year. Let's bring it back to local. A blockbuster year for the JSE. The CAPSWIX is up over 30%. The MSCI SA almost 52% in dollars. I mean, one of the best years in recent history. What surprised you most about the structure of this rally on the JSE?
Yeah, I think we must put it in proper context where more than 50% of the rally has come from platinum and gold shares. So, in fact, the domestic shares, many of them are down. The banks haven't done too well. So it's the global conditions that have pushed gold through the roof, and partly due to pushing platinum through the roof. Platinum is not a great long-term story. So there's been no new supply. So that's kicked up. And our gold companies are quite, you know, they've got quite high marginal costs. So an increase in the gold price is probably more impactful in their profits than the other gold companies around the world. So a lot of foreign investors have piled into the SA markets, and particularly the gold and platinum shares. Gold and platinum is now about 30% of our stock market. It's got very different dynamics, and we mustn't get deceived into thinking that it's a big positive vote on the SA economy.
Yeah.
Having said that, a lot of the SA economy stuff is looking great, partly because of, you know, the taxes on the gold and platinum companies result in big inflows for the government. We're looking at a 3% inflation target. You know, so the economics of South Africa are rapidly improving, and you've seen that most actually in bond yields. So 10-year government bond yields have come from 10.5%, 11% to 8.5%, which means that foreign investors are looking, you don't need to pay them as much to put their money here. So they're viewing us in a more positive context. That has yet to flow through into the kind of SA Inc. domestic part of the equity market, but we think it is starting to do so. So in our portfolios, we've recently been taking money out of gold and putting it into SA banks. And you can't really get two more different investments than a SA gold company and an SA bank.
Yeah, you certainly can't. And, you know, listen, looking at three fiscal surpluses, a much better, still not out of the woods, but a much better stabilizing debt trajectory and a positive outlook from S&P. Given the political pressures that must have been on the ANC to spend last week ahead of a local government election, I think investors are starting to see some stamp of the GNU on this administration. So it looks like a moment that really transforms our risk premier quite substantially. Given that, your strongest call is that alternative still, private debt, hedge funds, structured products, should be much bigger in terms of the size of a portion of South African investors' portfolios. You know, what's driving that conviction, and where do you see the biggest opportunity to shift some more into a kind of private markets portfolio for a retail investor? How do they access it?
Yeah, so I mean, that's been the issue. It's been very difficult to access. So, you know, part of the argument is markets have run very hard. The global markets are now at pretty much the highest valuation they've been in the last 30, 40 years. So it becomes more and more risky the higher prices are. I mean, it becomes a maths argument. Markets can come off 10, 20%. They could still, you know, we still remain positive, but more cautiously so. In the alternative space, it's a much lower return. Locally, we're trying to get 10 to 15% returns. Globally, 8 to 12% dollar returns. So if equities continue to pump, they'll underperform. But we like the risk-reward positioning of alternatives, where they, and interest rates around the world, while coming down, are still much higher than they've been for the last 10 years. So you can earn, you know, really nice returns on private debt locally and globally. Hedge funds are doing nicely with this volatility. You know, you can get nice yields of property and some nice private equity deals. So we've created two funds which give investors access to that market. I think it's very simply following a trend that's happened in America 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
Where you're just giving investors an ability to invest in a portion of the market which won't come tumbling down if equity markets do.
Mm. And what I like about private markets as well is, you know, markets, the one thing they've been is uncertain and volatile, especially at a time when you've got Trump in the White House. And to have a portion of your funds inside a private equity type structure where, you know, private equity GPs take long-term patient capital risk approaches to investing in businesses, I think those kinds of businesses are better geared to withstand volatility. They're not under the quartitis or half-yearly earnings pressures that listed companies are under. And again, you know, it's not putting all of your portfolio there, but I think we are underinvested as a whole, as South Africans, in private markets, despite Reg 28 allowing us much more in that space. So interesting to hear you've got two funds that retail investors can use as an access point. Just lastly, Peter, I mean, looking out at next year, when you look ahead, is it a year for caution or a year where the risk is in not taking risk?
Yeah, so I think we'll always err on the side of being invested in markets. You know, they go up 10% a year on average. So people have lost a lot of money out of being too cautious. So we would remain invested in markets. With new money, we're a little bit more cautious and, you know, doing stuff like the alternative space. And it's interesting to see. Today, I got the first report on my desk in terms of the global investment banks, Morgan Stanley, coming out as, you know, rampant bulls, going 7,800 on the S&P next year, 15% return for 2026. So it'll be very interesting to see. I think if you go back a year and 2 years ago, everybody was way too cautious. My intuition is they're probably all going to be a little bit too bullish. You know, people are getting caught up in it.
Yeah.
But I think the starting point is we're in a bull market, and we have been for the last 3 years, and we're not calling an end to that. So stay invested. I think we've got to pick our shares a lot more carefully. Make sure that, you know, kind of look at the companies that, you know, with valuations where they are, if companies disappoint on earnings, the punishment can be quite big in terms of share price decline. So we've got to be a lot more selective. But, you know, I just get a little bit more cautious as things continue to go up.
Peter, as always, a masterclass this year, reminding us that markets do reward that kind of discipline and diversification and calm heads in noisy times. But increasingly, 2026 does look set to reward those who stay brave, cautiously so, and on fundamentals, looking for those companies that have the balance sheets to withstand anything that the markets can throw at them. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.